Welcome to Season 7 of EdTech Insiders, the show where we cover the education technology industry in depth every week and speak to thought leaders, founders, investors, and operators in the EdTech field. I'm Alex Sarlin.
And I'm Ben Cornell. And we're both EdTech leaders with experience ranging from startups all the way to big tech. We're passionate about connecting you with what's happening in EdTech around the globe.
Thanks for listening. And if you like the podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review.
For our newsletter, events, and resources, go to edtechinsiders.org. Here's the show.
Nikhil Raghav is the CEO and founder of InventXYZ. Nikhil studied electrical engineering and business at Penn Wharton and interned at Intel, Google, and Microsoft before starting InventXYZ. In college, he ran Inventathons for middle and high school students to learn to build and code real products. He worked with schools in rural Pennsylvania and then remotely across the U.S. to teach computer science and electronics. For his work, Nikhil was awarded Penn's President's Innovation Prize to start InventXYZ. NFL player Travis Kelce tweeted that he was sponsoring a STEM lab for underserved kids in Kansas City, and Nikhil eventually collaborated with him, moved to Kansas City to help design and run the STEM lab. Now, InventXYZ makes it painless for middle and high schools across the country to teach 100% of their students computer science and AI, even if they don't have a dedicated teacher. Nikhil has also published a paper about teaching AI in K-12 with researchers from Johns Hopkins University, and we'll put a link to that on the show notes for this episode. Nikhil Raghav, welcome to EdTech Insiders.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk to you. So before we get into what you're doing with InventXYZ, I'd love to ask just a little bit of your background. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in computer science, in AI, in EdTech, and what brought you to this moment.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely a confluence of things from when I was in like middle school all the way up to college. But basically, the version of that story is I was trying to learn how to build real products ever since I was like in middle school. And I thought that I would learn how to do those things in middle school, then in high school, then in college. And then I realized I didn't. And actually, there was this post just like yesterday I was looking from a guy who goes to University of Waterloo, which is like the university in Canada. And he basically said the same thing that I've been feeling, which is, you know, Waterloo has all these amazing computer science and engineering graduates, but it's not because of the coursework. It's because they go out of their way to go and find side projects and build a portfolio and then find internships and co-ops. And that's like kind of the problem I've been seeing from middle school all the way up to college is that like, you know, there's a lot of like computer science and engineering and STEM like course content, but none of it prepares kids to do the right things to build real products. It's all like very heavily theory. So like my like specific story is in middle school, I wanted to create an Android app that like allowed me to define words just like on iPhone where you can just click a word and press define. And for whatever reason, Android only like made that feature 2 to 3 years ago. So my mom's a computer scientist. I thought, okay, like she can help me. Like she knows how to code. She gave me some book and I like it sort of made sense. And then I was totally lost when actually trying to make the app. And then in 10th grade, I took AP Computer Science A in Java. And I was like, this makes total sense. My teacher is great. She's explaining how everything is stored in memory and all of that. And then I tried again in 11th grade. And I realized everything I learned in the 10th grade computer science class and then the 11th grade sort of like an advanced data structures class was almost totally useless to building an actual app because we didn't learn the right things. We didn't learn how to fetch data from an external source, right? I was trying to get the definitions from Merriam-Webster. I had no idea what would happen. Like, would my app crash if I didn't use all of the definition information? Like, how do I make sure it doesn't lag? Like, I had no idea what the hell I was doing. And then I got to college and I thought, okay, well, this is going to be different. It's like, you know, university is where people learn how to build things.
Right.
And the only reason I know how to build things is because I was on the Penn electric racing team and we built an actual electric race car, but like almost none of the classes, except for just a couple of them, had us build real products. And so that was super frustrating to me. And I wanted to kind of fix that in education.
The problem that you're citing in education is one that I think a lot of people have been really starting to really, really understand.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting hearing from your perspective as a student, as a high school and college student, obviously have a lot of cultural capital. Your mom was an engineer. You know exactly where you want to go.
And still the schooling is, you know, the formal schooling is just sort of not able to get you there because it's too theoretical. So tell us how these experiences added up to lead to what you're doing with Invent XYZ and how you sort of launched that through your Penn Wharton experience.
Yeah. So I studied electrical engineering and business at Penn, as you kind of just hinted at. And while I was there, I started seeing school districts and private schools across the country launching these like maker spaces and innovation labs. And I was like, I wanted that when I was in school. So I went and interviewed and visited spaces across 9 different states. And I went in like super excited. And then I came out super disappointed because like they all had like essentially the same problems. Either it was actually just a big empty room with tables and chairs with wheels, or they had some cool stuff, but the person who was like initially there would leave after a year or two and nobody else knew how to use any of the stuff. So it would just sit there empty.
Yes.
So I initially thought, okay, let me try to solve that problem. And then towards the end of college, I ended up interviewing 54 superintendents and assistant superintendents and innovation directors in a span of like 3 weeks and realized that there's actually a little bit more of a nuanced problem in that, like, yes, the makerspace thing matters, but they also like actually need content in the first place. And one of them said, like, I don't want this space to be used just like 1 hour a month. I want it to be used every hour of every day. Give me hands-on STEM project for social studies. And I was like, wait, I can do that. That makes sense. That's kind of where the journey started. And then more recently, like there are now 10 states as of last month that have passed a law requiring every student to learn computer science in order to graduate from high school. But like, where the heck are the teachers, right? And to what I was saying earlier, like if we only have sort of like part-time teachers or people who like barely understand the stuff leading that class, then all kids are going to come out with is like learning some basic block coding and maybe sorting some random numbers with a for loop, which is a massive far cry from what we actually need, you know, supply the high-tech workforce of the future. And also, it's totally not what kids need to build their own products and start their own entrepreneurial experiences, right? So really trying to solve that problem of like, let's solve that teacher shortage and also let's solve the quality and content gap.
It's an inspiring take because I think you're putting together a lot of different pieces in the education system that have a little bit of a skew. One is the lack of teachers generally, but certainly the lack of teachers who have a lot of computer science background. And these states are passing laws, as you say, but they want to have training. They're trying to get training for teachers, but as we all know, there's not that much time. There's not that much money for it. And people who truly know how to code don't often become teachers. They often become coders because that's a whole different kind of career path.
There's a funny story that I keep hearing in like Florida and Texas for sure, which is they'll send teachers through the training, which essentially is the equivalent of the AP Computer Science Java course. And the teacher, you know, will get the certificate or whatever. And then a year or two later, they'll leave and get a $90,000 job as like entry-level engineer or like data science or like, you know, something to that effect, right?
Yeah. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. It's also sort of a problem baked into the system.
Right.
Which is really interesting. And then, you know, when you mentioned that you were trying to build products from when you were in middle school, that is such a specific, you know, mindset. So, you know, I was a product manager, but when I was in high school and college, I had never heard of a product manager. I'd never heard of building product. Yeah, it's just totally different generation. But I find it very interesting because I think people in your generation, very young, realize what the pathway is. You need entrepreneurial mindset. You need to be able to build products, to test products. Even the process that you just took, oh, I went and went to 9 states and then I interviewed all these directors. That's a product mindset. That's user research.
Yeah.
And I think there's such a gap, you know, between what young people are thinking about and they know they need to know to get these really lucrative jobs or very impactful jobs. And the education system just does not know that. So let's dig into what you're actually doing with Invent XYZ. So given your experience talking to all these people, teaching computer science, how does Invent XYZ build on that and tackle the challenge of sparking interest in technology and entrepreneurship and product among K-12 students?
Yeah, for sure. I'm also going to go back and answer the particular instance where the initiative notably impacted underserved communities, because I'll tell you 2 quick stories and then I'll come back to your question here, number 2. Okay, so, you know, before I graduated from college, I was like working, like I interviewed all these people and I was like working on sort of a prototype of Invent XYZ. And I had gone to like the National Superintendents Conference presented at the like School of the Future segment. And one of the superintendents said, oh, I'm in Pennsylvania too, I'm in. And I said, okay, great. I did not realize he was in a town of 13,000 people, 4.5 hours away from Philly. And I was like, you know, I got a bias for action, so I screw it. I'm just going to go drive over there and do it. And when I went there, you know, we had two projects for kids. One was to basically build and code their own Pong game in like algebra class. And then another was shooting a professional short film using proper lighting techniques in English class. Because a lot of times, like, English teachers have no idea what kids are actually interpreting the poems, right? They tell you what to interpret, but they don't actually know what you're thinking. And when I went there, I realized, wait a second, these kids talk about essentially the same stuff as the kids I grew up with, right? Like, they have gaming, like, GPUs and graphics cards. They play, like, the same games. They have Instagram. They, you know, like, daily life is not that different. What is different are the opportunities post facto and the expectations that they have for themselves, both in school and out of school, for, like, how far they can go. But, like, you know, GitHub is a totally remote company, for example. A lot of gaming studios are, like, kind of semi-remote now. Like, the next best company could be in St. Mary's area, Pennsylvania, town of 13,000 people, and there could be, like, I don't know, 10 kids or, like, 10 adults at that point making, like, 300, 400K a year in a town where a house only costs 100K to begin with. Okay, so now back to your original question, number two. Basically, what InventXYZ actually does is there are these computer science mandates that every high schooler and in some cases also every middle schooler needs to learn computer science to graduate. And so if you think about how that impacts schools, rural schools in general are going to just struggle to find anybody. Most schools are going to have to hire more than one computer science teacher because they just have that many students. And so even if they have one teacher, they're still going to struggle to find additional staff. And as we talked about earlier, like, even if they have staff, the things that they're teaching are not actually solving the workforce problems and, like, how to build real products, which is why, like, companies lobbied for these things in the first place.
Right.
So what we do is we create masterclass style projects featuring industry practitioners and industry challenges. So, for example, we have kids recreate historical empires using Unreal Engine, which is the software that Fortnite was built in. It's being used in the Batman and the Mandalorian movies. Architecture firms use it. We have kids analyze the DNA of a plant that's being attacked by a virus to figure out what gene could make it immune to that virus. And so this is a computational biology project in partnership with a researcher at Duke, right? So real scenarios. And then as students are doing the projects, we connect them with virtual mentors who are current college and master students. And we try to make sure that the students we collect have a variety of backgrounds and experiences so that every single student has somebody in the mentor team that they can talk to and be like, I want to be like that person in 10 years. And they're all, you know, sort of learning that engineering related field, right? And we try to make sure that they all know how to build real products. Like, they have a portfolio, like, so they know not just the basics, but, like, how to build real things. And then the last feature of our thing is STEM project for social studies, right? All of our content integrates into existing courses that kids already have to take. So all of this means that a school district doesn't have to hire any additional staff, and they don't have to retrain their existing staff to become computer science and AI and electronics experts, because our remote staff takes care of the technical stuff, and it correlates with their core content areas, meaning they could run a project for a month as a unit in their biology class or their history class or whatever.
That's key. I'm sure for schools to be able to adopt this, they need it to fit into their curriculum, into their year.
Right.
So I want to ask about each section of that, because it's a really interesting, it's a model that brings together the needs of totally different constituencies.
Yeah.
Right. So how do the educators and district leaders and the people in the school system react when you say, oh yeah, this is about English class, this is about social studies class, we have this, you probably have standards mapping, you know, how do they react to that?
Yeah, we get a variety of reactions. Some people are like, oh, my English teacher's never going to do this, which is fine, because if that you feel that is the case, that's okay. Do our InventXYZ projects in a separate STEM or computer science class. Maybe you need a paraprofessional in the room, that's fine. But now the computer science class is reinforcing your English. It's giving them extra time on the subject area. So now we're actually helping the teacher to, like, make sure they cover enough content, right? In some schools, especially where they're, like, a little bit more innovative, looking for project-based learning type experiences, they really like the stuff. And I mean, in general, the feedback that we get is, like, if you're going to put it in a core class, the standards alignment needs to be really spot on, and it needs to cover at least a unit's worth of stuff if the project takes almost a month, right? Otherwise, teachers will feel like they're losing time, which is a totally, like, I think that is like sort of the right way to look at it. And it's definitely taken us some time to like find that balance of making sure we're covering things, but not in a trivial way, right? It takes a while to figure out.
Completely. You know, there's something so interesting about what you're attempting with that, because you're taking the, you know, the standards-based curriculum, subject-based curriculum that is not designed at all for computer science or AI or, you know, any of these technology STEM subjects. I guess science and math technically have STEM stuff in them, yeah. But you're doing it with English and history and then saying you can learn these really important, you know, English and social studies concepts through this technology project, but the technology project is going to be really meaningful and going to give you a portfolio piece that you actually can use
right.
to get a job. It's a really noble attempt. It sounds difficult, but it sounds incredibly exciting as well.
Yeah. And then the third piece of that is it helps solve the engagement issue that schools are having, right? I mean, let's be fair, like honestly, school is probably not engaging for the vast majority of schools' existence, but especially post-COVID and like with the advent of smartphones and all of this stuff, it's like, you know, you hear constantly that teachers are having a really difficult time getting students to pay attention and to care about what they're talking about. So, I mean, at the end of the day, the goal is for students to learn, not necessarily for teachers to teach, right? Because the absorption is what they're measured on.
What they're measured on, what the students are measured on.
Yeah, yeah. And what the teachers and what the schools are measured on by the states, right?
That's true. So let's keep with the St. Mary's example, because I want to play this out. It's mm-hmm. really interesting. So you go to this relatively rural district in Pennsylvania, coming from Penn, having this idea. And when the kids hear, oh, it's an Unreal Engine project, the same engine that powers Fortnite yeah. and Batman, you know, how do they react?
Oh, okay. So that project didn't exist when I first started, right? But I'll explain like when we did it with one of the schools here in Kansas City. So I thought this was only going to be like boys raising their hand. And then I showed the trailer that we made for the project and everybody raised their hand pretty much. And I was like surprised. Like, first of all, kids know what Unreal Engine is, probably because before the game starts, there's the logo right there, right?
Exactly. Yes.
And then secondly, you know, like one of the schools that we worked with here in Kansas City, we did like a summer version of our projects there. And we did a project in Tableau where students analyze a data set that's interesting to them. So like sneaker sales or housing prices or crime data or TikTok influencers. And one of the kids there was like super getting it. He did like a custom formula following our tutorials and stuff. And then I was like asking him and interviewing him later. And he said, like, I asked him, wait, why are you in the summer class anyway? And he said, oh, I failed two classes, algebra and English. And I was like, hold on, you're like one of the smartest kids here. How did that happen? And he said, well, because I couldn't force myself to pay attention and care, right? So just flipping that key, like, you know, it's not necessarily going to flip it for the entire year, but at least for the couple of critical units, if we can flip that and have students really care about what they're doing, what we're having them do is probably harder than anything they've done in their life in terms of
for sure.
at least academics, right?
Harder and more relevant to the modern world yeah, than anything yeah. they're usually doing in regular algebra class. So you mentioned moving from your initial location in Penn to Kansas City. And there was a specific story and reason for that, which is pretty interesting. So tell us about what led to that move to Kansas City, why you're focusing on underserved kids there, and what led to that.
Yeah, I never thought I would be in Kansas City. But basically what happened is, so I was graduating from Penn. I was awarded their President's Innovation Prize to kickstart InventXYZ. And around that time, Travis Kelce had just signed a new contract and tweeted that he was sponsoring a STEM lab for underserved kids in Kansas City. So I tweeted at him, sent the Penn article about me. His manager told the school to call me and they said, hey, let's work together. So we ended up moving to Kansas City to help design that innovation lab. So my COO, Annette, and then Joseph, who's our like electronics curriculum lead, were basically the teachers for a year and a half, working with the students directly, developing new content, building tutorials, all of this stuff. And, you know, we developed a lot of empathy for teachers at that time because I understand why it's hard, right? It's not something that's for the faint of heart, for sure. And all the students, especially in some underserved communities, come from like rough families, or they might have IEPs that are sort of undiagnosed, or they might be diagnosed, but there's no way to like have special extra care for them, because there's not enough people. So like there are all these things that like we were trying to build a product that worked for students with drastically different backgrounds from ours, which I think in the long run is super helpful because 40% of American students are kind of in a similar boat, right? Socioeconomically and otherwise. And so we learned a lot there. And then in the last year and a half or so, we've been scaling to school districts across the country.
It's a really interesting story. So for our listeners who may not know this, that most people probably do, but you know, Travis Kelce, superstar tight end of the Kansas City Chiefs football team, which is why he is so dedicated to Kansas City. He's also now dating Taylor Swift, which has just made him one of the most famous people in the world, I believe. What strikes me so interesting about your approach to this, obviously you've been thinking about product and coding and this and entrepreneurialism from a very young age, but you're also very opportunistic in a lot of really clever ways. I mean, you're looking at all the different needs from these different constituencies, right? This football player who wants to help his community, the teachers who want to be able to teach their subject, but not necessarily go through lots of computer science training or that's not available to them. The school district leaders who have to legally teach, you know, computer science, but don't have the staff to do it. So they need outsourced staff. Even we haven't talked about this one much yet, but these mentors that you've just mentioned, people who are current students learning computer science or AI, who are getting the chance to, you know, pay back to, you know, in high schools around the country by supporting kids who are doing these amazing projects. I'm sure that has a little bit, maybe a lot of impact on their perspective too. Tell us about the experience of those folks.
To your question, like, so there's this concept of the like Richard Feynman technique. Basically, you don't understand something until you can explain it clearly to somebody who doesn't understand it. And so, yeah, there's an awesome like social impact component to like why students join our mission to like our organization to be mentors. And then there's also the like, I'm getting better at what I do because I'm essentially being a TA. And there's also the like the whole point about you don't learn how to build real products in college, for example.
Right.
We have students build real circuit boards here, and a lot of electrical engineers don't leave college knowing how to actually build and order a circuit board.
That's amazing. So in a way, your sort of super realist approach, let's do realistic, authentic projects that really will set people up for success in the workforce, is having a spillover effect, not only on the middle and high school students that you design it for, but also on the college students and maybe graduate students who are in these fields, but still aren't getting enough hands-on experience.
Right, right. Yeah, 100%.
It's amazing. So you mentioned the Penn President Innovation Prize, and that's a really interesting, you know, aspect of your story as well. You've been, you know, right in the middle of Philadelphia, in the middle of Penn doing this work. You've navigated urban and rural landscapes. I'd love to understand a little bit more about how all of these different experiences, which I imagine going into college, thinking about computer science, you probably didn't see a lot of this coming. You know, how has this changed your perspective on education technology, on society? How do you see the world differently because of these experiences?
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so I'll talk about this in two ways. One is that we like had to really revamp the way we were delivering this stuff multiple times and just figuring out like, how do I make this actually high fidelity? So like when I went to rural Pennsylvania, I was like guest teaching it for like a week or a couple of weeks, depending on the project. And then I'd leave and I set up a Google Meet. I like gave my number to the teacher so they can just like beam me up on the screen and call me if they need help. But when stuff is going wrong and you don't know what's going wrong, like it becomes really overwhelming fast. And so like the teacher didn't call me for like 3 or 4 days. And the issue that students were having was something that I could have fixed in like 2 or 3 minutes. Right. So that like asynchronous kind of like have the intermediary in there, like that doesn't work. And now with school districts across the country having like much more robust internet and like students also having much more robust internet at home, we've kind of changed our approach where like we basically directly beam into each student's computer and they have headphones and stuff. And that's like a lot easier, but it's also still really hard to debug electronics over a camera. So now we have to develop processes for students to say how they've connected things in a repeatable way that's like easy to debug, right? So like that's another thing we've built. And then how do you make like you get the same questions over and over again? How do you do that more efficiently and faster for students? So building a library of FAQ tutorials, and if students have the same question kind of at the same time, trying to route them to sort of the same mentor in small groups. The other thing I've like seen in sort of technology overall, like outside of how we're trying to use it to make our product a better experience for students and teachers, is like districts often talk about how, or like you see reports that like teachers have something like 120 or 420. I don't remember what the exact number was, like number of distinct apps that they use. Yeah, and like, that might be true. To me, that like doesn't sound crazy because like each one is just a website. Like, okay, like you go to a URL, but for people who are not necessarily like comfortable in that, right? Like they may not have grown up in the same, like there are only a few people who are roughly my age who are also teachers. I can see how that's like super overwhelming, right? And how many of those tech products are actually providing educational value versus providing like some sort of form collection system or like a student roster management system or like there's so much sort of like meta technology to manage the other technology, which I think is like kind of missing the point. Like, and I felt this about like when I was going into college too. I chose electrical engineering because I cared about computer science, but I also cared about the impact on the real world. Like, it doesn't matter if I'm making software that is only useful for other software or for like optimizing sort of minute things. Like, it needs to actually have value to humans.
We're at this really interesting moment. I'm sure you've encountered this in your travels with different schools and districts there. Post-pandemic, you know, during the pandemic, people adopted sort of anything they could get their hands on.
Yeah.
Often they were getting free trials for a while. And now post-pandemic, there's sort of this move to, you know, call back to the necessary, you know, quote unquote necessary technology that they think or know ideally is really, really working. And I think what you're talking about there is really interesting, this idea of this meta layer, that there's a lot of technology that's sort of there to help other tech or there for the system, there for the school's ease, which doesn't make it bad, but it does make it less relevant to the core mission of the school of teaching.
Right, yeah.
And it's an interesting lens to look at all of this through, because I think districts all over the country are trying to figure out what their strategy is. What do they need to keep? What do they need to double down on? And what might they, you know, let go or let the contract run out? It's interesting to hear a perspective of somebody walking into this space and saying, wow, you know, yeah, for you, hundreds of different tools doesn't sound overwhelming. You grew up in that environment. For a teacher that's had each of these sort of land on them and there's dedicated training for each one and they have to use it for particular moments, it might be a whole lot. We are seeing teachers say that they're pretty optimistic. I've been pleasantly surprised. Some of the surveys about teachers' use of technology, they're saying, hey, this, you know, it is working. Students are getting a lot out of it. It's a lot, but like, you know, we think that there's something really good there. They're not saying, get these things off of me. But at the same time, I think it's a really smart lens to say, you know, what are the core mission of the educational institution and how does tech serve that?
Yeah. And I mean, there's definitely some really great stuff, right? Like some of the stuff that I think is really cool and could have good educational impacts. Like I've never actually used this product, but I've seen the demo of like Prism's VR. And like, there's this other really cool demo that I saw from like a learning science group at Berkeley of like IoT sensors and like a visualization of like multiplication. So like you move the two sensors up and down, but one of them, like the bar on the screen, progresses twice as fast. So you kind of see that like ratio piece for that kind of standard. Like there are some really cool, like intuitive things that you can do. You can teach, for example, you can teach calculus. And specifically, like you can teach multivariable calculus without ever going into the formulas, right? Because you can teach the intuition behind all of this stuff very not complicatedly.
Yeah. I remember being in calculus class in high school and we had a terrific teacher, but he was constantly drawing, you know, the shapes and color in how it was, you know, you could fill in the rate of change. And it was like, wow, this is something that so easily now could be shown. Actually, Snap just this week announced they're doing some things with AR in classrooms that are just like that as well. They're trying to, basically they're starting to retire their AR technology. It didn't sort of work for them as a business, but they're starting to look into ed tech. And Anurupa Ganguly from Prism's VR, we interviewed her for this podcast that will be coming out just, I believe, next week.
Oh, cool.
By the time audience listens to this, it'll be already in the past. She was amazing. Really, really cool product. So yeah, I agree. There's some really amazing stuff happening. I mean, that's why we're, you know, in this space. You've mentioned, and we both mentioned sort of AI in passing throughout this conversation. You know, you're talking about electrical engineering, computer science projects that tie into core subjects like social studies, English, math. But AI is obviously coming to all of us. We just had this conference about AI in education. Tell us about some of your take about the AI, I know AI modules that you've already been doing into in Invent XYZ. What are you thinking about how to get AI into this equation of realistic projects happening in K-12 schools?
Right. Okay. So, and why I reached out to you in the first place, right, is like in that AI conference, you had a lot of stuff on like how to use AI tools to teach students. Not a whole lot around how do we teach students how AI works and how to build things with AI such that it deepens their learning of like whatever they're actually trying to learn.
100%. Such an important subject. Yes. Yeah. Tell us.
So basically, we have some projects and we're working on a suite of projects integrate different types of understanding. So I think it's just easier if I give you some examples. So I had earlier talked about that data science project in biology, analyzing the DNA of a plant to figure out what could make it immune to a virus. And it turns out, by the way, this is like a real scenario. 55% of the U.S. sugar crop is susceptible to such a virus that could wipe it out. And this kind of thing has happened in real life to bananas. Like, we have a monoculture of bananas, meaning all the plants are basically clones of each other, and they all get...
Just learned that this week. Somebody just told me that this week. It's so strange. Yeah. Yeah, please.
And so they all get wiped out by the same, like, fungus. And papayas also had a similar story. So... in our scenario for the sugar beet, it turns out there's actually a wild variant of the beet that has some resistance to the virus that's wiping it out. But what happens if there is no wild variant that's immune to this virus? How do you solve that problem? And so the like extension into AI in this piece is we have students basically randomly generate mutations. And then from there, we give them like essentially like, okay, we, you know, use CRISPR to like put this in a lab and test all the things. How do we know which ones worked? Which mutations actually mattered and which ones didn't matter? Because it's bad to keep in extra mutations because they might have some other side effect. So then to do that, they actually go through a data science process called PLSR, which is basically about shifting your perspective to figure out which of these things are correlated with survival and which mutations are also correlated with each other. Because sometimes you do like one small grouping of mutations and your like survival rate goes up, but then you add like one other mutation and your survival rate goes down, right? So like which cluster actually is important? And that process using PLSR or like related techniques like PCA and so on is a very realistic kind of data science that people do. And, you know, AI is not just the GPTs of the world, right? It's not just like text generators. And so like, you know, that's kind of like why it came into significance. But actually when we do like presentations at conferences or like trainings for teachers, I'll break down AI into essentially four different categories. So one is like language models and or generative AI. And I include like image generation pieces as well in there. But the point is that it has some kind of representation in like some kind of 3D multiple dimension space of like, where words belong and like how to get from one word to another word, right? Or like how concepts relate. The second type is signal processing. So that's like analyzing audio and video and trying to find correlations within itself. Then the third type is more of that traditional data science like we do in that project I just mentioned. And then the fourth type is reinforcement learning, which is like similar to teaching a baby to walk. You give it some objectives and some rewards. And reinforcement learning is by far the most complicated and like hardest to train. But, you know, try to split that up, give some specific examples. And then I actually have teachers like come up with examples or I'll suggest examples to them and ask them like, okay, which versions of AI is this? And in some cases, it might be more than one, right? But really trying to like split apart the understanding. And like the key thing about AI is you really need to understand matrices. But again, like I was talking about with calculus, I don't need you to like understand the formulas and how it turns into systems of equations. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is we can represent things in multiple dimensions and give them sort of a coordinate in space. And things that are closer together in space are related. Or like we can shift the way we look at the space to want things that should be related closer together. That's the piece that we want kids to understand. And then doing that enables them to understand deeper insights, right? So for another one of our projects is for like government class, where we have students analyze the text of Supreme Court cases using AI tools again. So they do sentiment analysis, they do like topic modeling and clustering. And one of the things is bias in AI comes in multiple ways, right? So one is you just like don't think about the scenario that you're trying to analyze and you're using a model that's just not fit for purpose. And so one of the most popular sentiment analysis models actually basically hard codes like specific words to a sentiment. And so when you like initially run this model, like every case comes out with like a negative sentiment. Why is that? And it turns out like police, government are all hard-coded as negative. So like that might have made sense in one context. It sure as hell does not make sense in the context we're using it for. So really helping kids understand that like piece of the ethics and the context, right?
Yeah. I mean, hearing you talk about the types of subjects, you sort of mentioned casually in passing there, teaching CRISPR, teaching AI ethics, teaching bioengineering, you know, computational biology. These are not traditionally subjects that at least I associate with K-12 at all. And if so, it's usually at the highest level. Like you learn Plessy versus Ferguson, you know, you learn a handful of Supreme Court cases. Yeah. You certainly aren't analyzing the text of them as a corpus for an AI model for sentiment analysis. It strikes me as, you know, it's so your perspective on education and the future of it, I think is really prescient for where we should all be thinking in this age of AI. It's just a very different world. You don't have to be limited to the same old subjects. You don't have to be limited to the same old types of projects. The capacity of students and teachers to do amazing things is just, it's there. It's here already.
Yeah.
So it's really just the four quadrants or the four sort of types of AI that you just mentioned feed into my next question, which is that you have written a paper with Johns Hopkins researchers about K-12 AI education. And, you know, we're in this moment where President Biden has just put out an executive order ordering sort of every department in the government to start really thinking much harder and faster about how AI is going to work, including the Department of Education. And they have a mandate to create this AI toolkit for K-12 about how to use it. Some of the things you're thinking about feel very AI toolkit ready.
Yeah.
Tell us about this paper and how you've structured it and how you're structuring your program to sort of meet what you've discovered in it.
Yeah, for sure. So it's a peer-reviewed paper co-authored with some engineering researchers, as well as a learning scientist researcher at Johns Hopkins, and then also a congressman from New York. And basically the perspective is, so like the education researcher is Dr. Jonathan Plucker, and his whole research is primarily around like creativity and like, what is it? And like, how do you emphasize it? How do you, is it something that can be learned? And like, the answer is yes. But how do you use AI scenarios to enhance students' learning in terms of creativity and depth of knowledge? So we give a bunch of scenarios of like what that actually looks like and some sort of sample like one-pager lesson plans. So like some stuff that I haven't talked about in our discussion so far is like one in physics where this is a signal processing example. So like I'll give you sort of the inspiration piece and then the actual example, right? Like your Apple Watch, or like if you have an Apple Watch, it can detect when you have like a heart attack, or it can detect when you're in a car crash and like call the ambulance. How the heck does it do that? So it turns out like it has some sensors in there. The sensors measure like motion and, but like, what does this motion mean? Like to the sensors, it's just like some lines on a graph, right? And so with signal processing, you can correlate certain funky patterns of wiggles with specific movements. So in physics, we have an example in there that's like using motion sensors to figure out like the impact level of a force, right? Like, what is the change in acceleration that's happening? And what does that impulse look like? And then based on that, you can kind of categorize what kind of impact it is. And to do that, you basically do some signal processing on the sensor data. And that kind of thing is like, yes, that's how like the Apple Watch works. But it's also like, for example, there are some motion capture suits and like animation, right? And they have like a bunch of sensors strapped to you. That's how also they figure out like where your skeleton is and how do you calculate that and how do you counteract for like drift and some other issues, right? So like we give some examples like that. We talk about how it's really important to use AI to help kids see unexpected connections, because that is kind of the basis of creativity, right? Like if you think, for example, the like InMenXYZ solution is creative, it's creative because we're making leaps that like are not traditionally made across the different constituents and across the like program design. But the only reason I can do that is because I have a lot of knowledge sort of memorized in the first place. And I like have a lot of knowledge about a variety of topics. And I can think about them and process them at another level and say, wait a second, these two ideas are related. What if I like took this process from, I don't know, let's say agriculture and then plopped it into filmmaking and things like that, right? So like, yeah, we talk about how we can create these AI modules where students are learning how AI works and building their own models so that they can better create a creative mind and better understand the core content that they're actually learning.
Amazing. I have heard the relationship between AI and creativity brought up more in the last few months, especially in the generative AI era than ever before. I mean, I think it's an important thing to think about because in the decades that AI has sort of been around, it's often been thought of as a mathematical, it's about matrices and regressions and, figuring out patterns in data, which is very important, but doesn't necessarily feel creative. But when you think about where we're at now with AI, it is incredibly creative. And, deciding where to point these AI tools and how to use one technique in an interdisciplinary way or, in another context is everything. And kids love creativity. I mean, this is like, this is something that I think young people who don't necessarily have enough context knowledge to do some of this, to your point, but also don't have some of the limitations. They don't see everything as siloed, right? They don't see all these disciplines as totally different. Might be a source of incredible creativity when it comes to this stuff. I can't wait. Actually, I'd love to ask you about this. You are obviously trying to put tools in the hands of students. That's sort of core to everything you've been doing. Do you think we're close to the time when we're going to be able to put, really powerful generative AI tools, let's say video creation tools, in the hands of students in school? I mean, you think that's 6 months away, 3 years away? What do you think?
I don't know that the technology is necessarily the limiting factor, and I'll give you an example.
It's not. Oh, definitely not.
No, it's more the like legal, the understanding and the process around it, right? It's more
and
than
the
like
policy and privacy policy. And the, a lot of different things. But yeah, I'm curious how you think about it. Like, how could it happen?
Okay, so there, I'll give you an example of like something that we're thinking about for a project as well. And we just barely have been messing with it, but I think it would work pretty well. So there's this concept called like photogrammetry, where basically you take a bunch of pictures of a 3D space, and then using some math, you figure out like where each picture actually is in space, and then like construct a 3D model from it with like good colors and textures and stuff. And that process is okay, but it's like a little bit error prone sometimes, and it like is a little slow. So then like maybe last year there was another process that was like essentially the same, but like via video. So you have a bunch of pictures. Photogrammetry, like to take a picture of our entire studio, I'd probably need at least 200 pictures, if not more than that. This new thing called a NERF, like you can move your camera around and just like record a quick video and it'll like generate sort of the same thing with a similar level of fidelity. And then there's another one now that came out like maybe a month-ish ago called Gaussian splatting, which is even better and is also way faster. Like it runs almost in real time. And you can do it with video too. So for like Halloween, I dressed up as Neo from The Matrix. And one of the things that I want to test is basically doing like bullet time with like just a phone or a couple of phones, right? And then like the phone might have only been in one location while we recorded this thing, but because of this Gaussian splatting algorithm, now I can like move the camera in 3D. And tools like that, there's like Luma AI, for example. And if like schools have CAD labs or a lot of schools are interested into like esports now. So if they have computers that have the graphics cards, like you can run these models locally. I mean, yes, there's a little bit of a pain in tooling, and maybe that's something we need to build on our side to make a nice UI to use it. But like kids can run this stuff and like do cool videos like that, right? And it's not that far away. Now, in terms of like privacy rights and stuff around like Gaussian splatting, I think it's fine. In terms of like deepfakes, obviously that's where like most people are concerned. I think there are lots of ways to use deepfakes for good. One of the things that we're looking at is like a deepfake professor that's like the student, but like 10 years older.
Wow.
Yeah. And then like empower it with our FAQ knowledge so that the student can ask questions at any time. I think we're a few years away from that, mainly because deepfakes don't currently really run in real time all that well.
Right.
But yeah.
That is super interesting. So wait, let's just come back around. So we're talking about AI potential in schools, and you're saying this Gaussian splatting is a really good example of something that is a very powerful, very modern tool that would be a lot of interest to kids doing creative projects, even in the service of, they could do that for historical places, or they could do it for, the house in the Raven. It's a really exciting vision to give tools of that power and that modern nature to students, both because they can be creative with it and because it teaches them how to use modern tooling for their lives, which is, when they are 18 and graduate from high school, this world is going to be completely filled with tools of that nature and ones we can't even imagine yet.
So like today is like essentially 8th and 9th graders graduate in like 2027-ish. And if they don't go to college, like we need to empower them to actually be able to do real things that'll get them jobs that pay at least a living wage, if not well above that. right? And so like my internal threshold for that is basically 70 to 220K starting salaries. And, you know, I tell some superintendents this and they're like, I get paid 200K. This guy is like blowing smoke up his ass. But like, it's real, right? Like those are like real starting salaries. Like that's how, like not necessarily straight out of high school, but straight out of college, for sure. Like people who graduated with me made 190 straight out of college, plus like a signing bonus, right? It's already a thing. And for those kids, they will graduate college in like 2030, 2031, right? So we need to be preparing kids for 2030, 2035. And it's not, oh, those jobs haven't been invented yet, so I'm going to teach kids just soft skills. You can't learn soft skills without doing a hard thing in the first place. Like you can't learn teamwork without having something meaningful to work on a team with. You can't learn critical thinking or grit without having done something really hard that requires critical thinking and requires multiple attempts, right?
Interesting. Yeah. I've never heard it put that way. That's a really interesting take.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's something
you can't, learn soft skills without doing hard things. It sounds like a bumper sticker, but in a good way.
Maybe I should make a bumper sticker.
I like that. Yeah. So, you know, I have one more question for you and then we should wrap, even though there's obviously so much here to unravel. I feel like we've only scratched the surface of some of the things, you know, we've begun talking about today. But I guess the question is, in this moment, you know, we're here in 2023. It's only been a year since generative AI came along, and it's only been very recently that it's sort of universally acknowledged that AI has to have a place in education. We have to teach some version of the skills. We have to use the tools. We have to allow teachers to use the tools for themselves and for their students. How do you see the next few years getting, you know, the far future is just too mucky to see. We try, but how do you see the next few years evolving in terms of people coming closer to your grand and I think very cutting edge vision of what, you know, middle school and high school should look like?
Yeah. So there's a Wharton professor named Ethan Mullick, and he's like got a lot of followers on Twitter and probably LinkedIn as well. And one of the things that he does in his class is like, you are required to use a generative chat tool. And that helps you also figure out what the limitations of those tools are and what they really excel at, right? And so I think it's really important to reframe the activities we do in education, because it can be a super powerful tool, even if it's just using like a, you know, off the shelf ChatGPT or Claude or Bard or whatever, right? Like, for example, you can do like a Socratic seminar wherein one of the participants is a chatbot, or you can have students write an essay using the chat tool, evaluate the essays from each other and go, wait a second. It's got a good language, but like, did it really say anything?
Right.
Or is this citation real? Oh, it got the authors right, but I don't know where this actual paper is. By the way, I'm into like workout science and like food science. So I asked it something about like, what's the optimal protein intake? And like, is there any study around how much protein one can use for muscle building in a single meal? And it like cited some articles, and the researchers were absolutely right, but the articles did not exist, right? So it's actually very important for students to see those points where it breaks and for teachers to see that, because that's a great learning opportunity. So I think in the next few years, I think a lot of schools are going to start doing the like basic stuff of, let's use a generative tool as like an activity in an English class. Let's adopt something like CuraPod or whatever that like helps generate some good explanations. And I hope that will like raise the standard of what students learn while also lowering the amount of effort teachers have to put in, right? Because if you can use these tools to like semi-auto grade students' responses, and I'm not saying like entirely grade it with AI, but at least if you can cluster like 150 papers down to like essentially three categories of the way in which they frame their argument, now grading becomes so much faster, right? So I think there's definitely going to be space for teachers to start like just looking for tools that make their life easier, and probably a freemium model there. And I think there's going to be a very not freemium model for stuff like ours, where it's like a much more immersive, changing what students actually learn experience. And I think there's probably both of those things are going to have legs.
Yeah, that's a very compelling take. And I think it makes a lot of sense to me. The idea of auto grading is a really interesting one. And we talked to a couple people at the conference who are doing auto graders of various kinds. And one of the things that they say, they always have to give the same disclaimer that you just gave, you know, this is not about replacing teachers or expert graders, but what it is about is taking a few things. It's being able to give students rapid feedback about what they're doing mm-hmm. without having to wait a week or two teacher to give them. We know that's important. It's also about putting some of the sort of metacognition in the students' hands, right? It's like, there's a great story in the conference from Ben Waitley, who was one of the founders of Memrise, where he was talking about his daughter had a, you know, an assignment, and they told her she was allowed to use ChatGPT. So she used it and came out with a product. And he said, okay, now great, but like, how well are you going to do on that? Like, how is the teacher going to, you know, is it good? And she was like, well, ChatGPT helped me write it or wrote it for me. He's like, well, now use ChatGPT to figure out if it's good or not and make it how to make it better. And it was like a little light bulb went off, and she went back and, you know, basically tried to create a whole model for ChatGPT to grade her own paper using the type of rubric and thinking that the teacher might use. And it's like, you know, that's metacognition, and that is very hardcore learning. It's really interesting to think about it that way. And then what the teacher can do, instead of having to, you know, cross out the misspellings or say, this is an awkward phrasing, they can say, okay, let me zoom out and actually look at this and not have to focus on these tiny things. Instead, look at the entire submission as a full submission and actually think about it at the height of my intelligence rather than having to come all the way down to these mini errors that students are making that really are sort of not that relevant to anything.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting world to imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. So like kind of relatedly experience wise, in college, I was like one of the head TAs for the embedded systems class. So it's like the more advanced version of Arduinos basically. And we used Gradescope to like grade quiz and like submissions. And then we realized after using Gradescope that it was actually just faster to just like manually grade the papers, right? So like the user interfaces were not there yet. And the way of clustering responses was not a thing. And I came up with this idea of like clustering responses like back then too. Like with one of our first schools, we tried to do that. And I think you really need some like LLM or like a vector database or something to do it, because we tried some of the more naive language processing techniques and it just didn't work. Because you just only have like 15 kids, right? Like that's not enough.
Right, right. There's been some interesting work on that in programming assignments where you can sort of find the same types of errors in multiple submissions. But
Yeah, absolutely. So like having a better procedure and interface for that, I think is going to be a big game changer. And as you're saying, like giving students the metacognition features, like you're applying for grants, when you're applying for like a job, you have to think about what the other person is looking to see, what will convince the other person. That exactly. is basically the same thing as looking at a rubric and just like, okay, I can answer these things. But like, there's also a little bit of creativity involved of, you can't just like go check off all the bullets in a linear fashion. You kind of have to still make it cogent.
You definitely have to still make it cogent, right? Because that's sort of the minimum. The rubric is what people are looking for, but then you want to go beyond and say, okay, but this is an amazing idea beyond. We didn't just check the boxes.
Right.
And I think, you know, there's a real equity piece to that too, because I think a lot of students in private schools are sort of taught how to think like that early on. And a lot of students in public schools or underserved schools aren't. It's just sort of not how they're trained to think about homework, you know, and it creates, I think, a real gap in how the graduates of different types of schools in America are able to do things in the rest of the world, because they haven't been sort of trained to think of how is the teacher going to interpret this? How do I do something that is going to make them really understand and respect and, you know, admire my work? And that is such an important thing to be able to do when you're applying to college, for example, or applying to a job.
Yeah. So like I visited my cousin in India in January and December, and I didn't know that there was a school right next to their house until like I came this time. So it's a government school in India, and they basically, the way they teach is like the teacher will say something and the entire class has to repeat it back at the same time. And it's like this sort of like weird rote memorization thing. And it's not that rote memorization is bad. It's just like lack of context, lack of like that metacognition piece just makes it feel very detached and like not usable. Right. But you contrast that with like a massive portion of Indians go to private schools and pay like pretty hefty tuitions, and they're better about it. It's not like everybody repeats the thing, but there's still like not a lot of metacognitive pieces. Like one of the complaints that I make is that when I go to India, like a lot of the engineering graduates or like design graduates or whatever, the TV, like HD television shows on India in Indian channels are sometimes stretched and squashed. Like they don't understand aspect ratio and some of these like important things for like the user interface. And it's like, man, you're not teaching like really basic attention to detail pieces and metacognitive pieces and like having pride in your work. And, you know, there are obviously people in India who have those skills, but it's like, you know, when people here talk about like, we need to teach kids critical thinking skills, like, I mean, that's true. Like, this is something that America absolutely needs to do. But like, again, you got to teach it in context with the modern tools. So like, yeah, interesting discussion. And like, it's making me connect the dots in interesting ways.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm going to really chew on that idea of you know, you can't teach soft skills without doing hard things. That is a really interesting concept that really changes the way that I think about these soft skills, they sometimes call them,
yeah,
you know, durable skills or 21st century skill or, you know, all sorts of different power skills. But the idea that it only makes sense to teach them when you're doing something really meaningful or potentially very difficult makes a lot of sense. I mean, that is how the work world is. You don't often have to work in a huge team to do something very simple that you could have all done, you know, one person could have done. That's not how the world works. When you're working in a huge team, you're doing something incredibly complex and very far reaching. And it makes sense to model that in school.
Yeah, definitely.
I like it. Okay. So we have reached our final questions. What is the most exciting trend that you see in the education technology landscape right now that our listeners should keep an eye on? And ideally, this is something that, you know, you have an eye towards, which you have obviously a very good sense of where things are going that other people may not see coming.
Yeah. Okay. So I think the massive disparity in like teacher salaries and the kinds of people we want to attract as teachers is a problem that is bubbling up very obviously now. You know, you can't expect, like, for example, my COO Annette is from Carnegie Mellon and she has a master's in Meki and stuff. Like, if you want like an engineering teacher, you can't expect people like her to become a teacher, right? Like, she can make more at Apple, she could start a startup, like whatever it is. But you want at least maybe not a CMU grad necessarily, but like a Missouri grad or a KU grad, like you want those kinds of people in schools, so that you can raise students' expectations of themselves and what they can do. But if the salary is only, you know, 30, 40 grand, like, yes, there's a pension, but like that is 30 years away. I'm not thinking about the pension, right? So that disconnect and like, you know, 10%, 15% raise is not solving the problem of getting the wrong people in schools. You need a structural shift. And like, there are some that are like remote teacher, like we beam in somebody from Jersey into an underserved urban school that's really having a problem staffing like a chemistry teacher or something, right? That sort of works. But the problem is still fundamentally that we have a shortage of qualified people to teach at the given salary range. And so either you need to like outsource people or do something kind of like what we're doing, or you got to like massively, totally change the salary structure. And I think states are looking at it. Some districts are looking at like doing innovative things like changing that structure. I think that area is like something that is going to be something majorly innovated on in the next, I don't know, 5-6 years, probably.
I love that. My co-host on our podcast talks often about the $100,000 teaching job.
Oh, yeah.
And
I think it should be a $200,000 teaching job.
There you go.
Right? Like, I want people who have gone to med school, have been a doctor for 2 years or 3 years or something, who then decide to be a teacher. Or somebody who worked at Google for a couple of years or built a startup and like their second job, not after 40 years, but after like 6 or 7 or 10 years is being a teacher. That's the caliber of people that students should be learning from, because we think about education as this sort of a sacrifice, right? Like a martyrdom kind of thing.
The opportunity cost is humongous.
Yeah, but that's not how we should be thinking about this. We should be thinking about, especially in the global context of like China coming from dirt poor country in the 70s and 80s to like this amazing behemoth, they really invested in education and especially in like STEM related things. And now there are like smartphones cannot be built in the US because there are simply no factories that can build precision circuit boards in the way that is required for phones and laptops and a lot of these things.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But a lot of these components and suppliers and factories are there in China, right? Like if we want to compete on the global stage of regardless of what industry we're talking about, we really need to change the priority of like how we think about education.
It makes me think of an idea, and this has never occurred to me before, but your idea about teachers have all of these professional development opportunities, and basically the more training they do and the more degrees they have, the higher their salary tends to go. And that's sort of a structural. I wonder if there was a world in which, you know, somebody with a PhD in chemistry, if they wanted to come back and be a high school teacher, well, that PhD in chemistry makes it that the salary is $150,000 because they are so well trained that they can be a, like, maybe that's already exists somewhere, but or if they have, you know, sold a startup, you know, to Google, then that is counts as experience that would raise their teaching salary. And a school can actually recruit that person and say, hey, look, we can pay you more and you might have a really amazing time teaching the next generation of kids and inspiring them with your experience, but we'll actually make it worth your while rather than you going to another tech company. Like, I wonder if that's a world that we will see.
I think there's probably something coming down the line of like the way Netflix does hiring, which is encourage everybody in the company to interview with other companies like on a regular basis to figure out what that person's worth. And then they decide, okay, are they worth that much to me? Yeah. Okay. We'll just raise their salary by that and maybe a little bump. And if they're not worth that much to me, give a generous severance package and let them move on to the other company, right? So in education, kind of as you're hinting at, there could be something where like maybe there's just like a second class, because like most of these salary schedules top out at like 80 grand or 90 grand or something, right? Like even if I put that PhD person on the like 30-year rung, it still wouldn't be competitive.
Right.
So you almost need like a second category of, we want these like actual professionals who have like some level of experience. And for those people, we'll pay them what they're worth. And maybe the state has a separate allocation for that. Like that could be something that, like, I know some of the states are like looking at like raising the minimum threshold and stuff, but like, yeah, maybe that's the other approach. And it might actually be cheaper to do that way, because you only need like, I don't know, 6 or 7 teachers like that.
Right, exactly. It could be a whole different, I mean, it would be, obviously this isn't meant to be, hey, we should not pay teachers more, all teachers more, because all teachers deserve more. But it's just interesting to reduce the opportunity cost to become a high school teacher, because it's so high now if you already have put all this money into your education or have spent years, you know, building startups or building or working in tech.
And it's like, to your point, there are dedicated skills that are specific to teaching and specific to managing young students that absolutely need to be learned. And like, it takes a couple years.
Right.
And the startup person and the professor are not necessarily going to be good at that, right? Like, there are plenty of terrible professors in colleges that are amazing at research and really bad at teaching.
Don't get me started on that. Yeah, this concept of pedagogical content knowledge. But even so, there's got to be some way to sort of change the perception and feeling of the teaching profession so that it doesn't feel like it's always that it's limiting your own income for life. It's just not, it doesn't make sense that way. Okay. Last question. What is a resource that you would recommend for anybody who's listening to this who wants to dive deeper into the topics we discussed today?
Yeah, for sure. So I guess in the show notes, you'll have a link to our stuff. We'll have a video there. And then if you're interested, I guess you can also click the link to see kind of our different projects and sessions and timings. But then another like actually useful resource in terms of like education and pedagogy is there's actually a database of learning science studies, and it has like meta-analyses, meaning multiple papers have like studied this concept and trying to figure out like what the overall impact actually is. And you can, it basically ranks every type of intervention based on what the standard deviation of improvement and students' outcomes are. And so we'll link that as well. It's, I think, one of the failings of a lot of professional development is teachers don't actually understand the latest recommendations in learning science. And that's a tragedy, because like this thing is happening over here in this like small cluster of education researcher PhDs, and it's not being translated to the actual practitioners because they do a terrible job of communicating it. Right.
Like,
it's just totally distinct. So any way that we can get more people actually understanding what has been tested, what actually might work, what sample sizes, because sometimes the sample sizes are still really small. And the other also thing to note there is, just because something has been studied once doesn't mean something that hasn't been studied is bad, right? Like, you need to have an idea and then have a hypothesis to create data. You can't simply only look at data, because then you're only looking at things that we have already tried. But there are always going to be new things that we haven't tried that might be significantly better than the old things. So like, you need both, but you have to measure them properly.
Yeah. Very interesting point. So we will put links to all of the Invent XYZ materials, videos, and curriculum so people can look deeper into that. And we'll put a link to that database of learning science studies and meta-analyses, because I think it will be very interesting for our listening audience to explore that as well. Nikhil Raghav, this has been an incredibly interesting discussion. I'm really glad to have connected with you and learned about what you're doing with Invent XYZ. You're clearly looking in all sorts of ways at the future of education, the future of AI, the future of, you know, project-based learning and the workforce. And it's really exciting to see what you're doing in K-12 schools with middle schoolers, with high schoolers, and even with these AI mentors, as well as teachers. Thank you so much for being here with us on EdTech Insiders.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of EdTech Insiders. If you like the podcast, remember to rate it and share it with others in the EdTech community. For those who want even more EdTech Insider, subscribe to the free EdTech Insiders newsletter on Substack.
This season of EdTech Insiders is brought to you by Tuck Advisors. Tuck Advisors is a trusted name in education M&A, founded by serial entrepreneurs with over 25 years of experience starting, investing in, and selling companies. Tuck Advisors believes founders deserve M&A advisors who work as hard as they do.